Go ahead and dig into our text then, 2 Samuel chapter 13. We're still in the section that we've titled The First Fruits of Reaping What You Sow. David has, through that one act of disobedience, sowed a pretty bountiful harvest of trouble into his household. Because of that one act, of course, I guess it wasn't really one act, it was a whole string of acts, right? But they all lumped into that one period of his life. He's going to see the consequences of that sin far into his lifetime. Because his oldest son, Amnon, has taken a liking to his half-sister, Tamar. And as we looked at that last week, he had the help of a friend, which was actually his cousin, David's nephew, Jonadab, who helped him formulate a plan to try to seduce this girl. And so Amnon pretended to be sick. And when Dad came to visit him, Amnon requested that his sister Tamar come and make the word that we get translated for here is cakes. But as we said last week, don't think birthday cake, think pancake. Anybody have pancakes this last week? A couple of our family. Yeah, pancakes are a frequent staple at our house, except we don't just do Bisquick or what are those Hungry Jack pancakes, right? They're called peanut butter chocolate chip pancakes. So it's only slightly better for you than eating a cookie. No, it's actually really good. But put peanut butter in the recipe and you put some chocolate chips in. It tastes like you're eating a Reese's peanut butter cup for breakfast, but it's really good. I doubt Tamar's cakes had chocolate chips in them. Probably didn't even have peanut butter. But they were a good, hearty kind of breakfast cake for Amnon to eat, supposed to strengthen him. When she finished cooking it, Amnon sent all the servants out of the house, or out of the room that he was in. He went in and laid down in his bed. It's called the chamber where he slept. And he called Tamar into him. And when she set the cakes down, he forced himself upon her despite her protestations. In verse 12, she says, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. And as for me, where could I carry my shame?" She's trying to appeal to his sense of conscience, because this would have been an act that would have been considered on the fringe. This would have been an extremely strange thing to happen. Now, immorality was not much less rampant than it is today, but even today, for a man to rape his half-sister, it's considered somewhat of a strange thing. And so she's telling him, "Look, Amnon, if you do this, you're going to be considered one of the outrageous people. You're one of the people that's way off there out in left field." Pardons to anybody that actually played left field. You know, it's just a euphemism, okay? You're one of the outrageous people in Israel. And I, now she's trying to plead to his sense of compassion, "Think about what you're going to do to me. What is this going to mean to me? I will never be able to get married because of this." That considered a sense of great shame then for a woman to have had this experience, and very few men would have wanted to marry her. But verse 14, he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. So Amnon has given in to the deception of sin. Sin tricks us, folks. It is constantly trying to deceive us on many different fronts. The same way that Satan tried to deceive and succeeded in deceiving Adam and Eve in the garden, sin works that way now. Except now it's not about eating a forbidden fruit. Now it's about a whole host of things. Whatever it is God says don't do, as soon as we hear the command, our sinful nature wants to rebel against it, and we're very quick to believe its lies. Some of the lies it tells us, obviously, can be broken down to the one statement: sin tells you God is wrong and you're right. You want this thing? You should be able to have it. Adam, you want to be knowledgeable? You want to be wise? Why would God withhold that from you? He's obviously trying to keep you down. God is obviously trying to keep some good from you. That cosmic killjoy argument has been around since the beginning, and people are still believing it. God just wants to spoil your fun. He doesn't want you to enjoy yourself. And so that's why he tells you no. But that's not what our God is like. But that's what sin does. It's constantly trying to trick us, tell us God's wrong. So it tells us God's wrong in his motivation. It tries to tell us God's wrong in the consequences. If you do this, it'll never happen to you the way God says. What did God tell Adam would be the result of his sin? In the day you eat of it, you will surely die. Oh, Adam, you will not surely die. It's not going to happen that way. How often have we heard the argument from people when we say this certain action, whatever it is, it's wrong, it shouldn't be done. People say, oh, it's not that big a deal. Nobody gets hurt by it. Though it's the whole thing now in the marijuana laws they're trying to pass, right? Oh, it doesn't have all the bad of effects. Well, doesn't it? In everything that God commands us in, go through the top 10. Those 10 commandments that are a summary of God's law. It's not that the 10 commandments are the most important out of the whole law. It's that those 10 commandments summarize the rest of the law, right? So, first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. Oh, how bad is it going to be if you have another god before God? People live that way and their lives go perfectly fine, don't they? After all, we're a nation of diverse religious influences and opinions, aren't we? And those people live out perfectly normal lives. They're prosperous, they're healthy, they're happy, aren't they? Well, they might be, but that's beside the point, isn't it? But God commanded that it's wrong. You shall not make any graven image to yourself. Really? Oh, come on. What bad consequence is going to come from having a graven image? I mean, don't you have statuary in your house somewhere? Well, you don't bow down and worship it. That's a whole different thing, isn't it? But look at all the people throughout the world in different religions. They have statues and they have idols that they bow to and they offer to. And doesn't life go well for them? You know what one of the arguments was in Israel during the period of the kings? I'm getting ahead of myself because we'll get there in our study of these kingly lessons. But one of the arguments, close to the time of the Babylonian captivity, all right, Babylon's encroaching on Israel. They're taking out country after country after country. And you know what the Israelites are saying to the prophets? You know what? When we worshiped Baal, things went a lot better for us. Let's go back to that. You prophets are always calling us back to the worship of Jehovah exclusively. But when we worshiped Baal, everything was good. We were prosperous, we were happy, we were safe. And that's one of the lies that sin tells us. Are they prosperous? Are they happy? Are they safe? Idol worship? Doesn't matter, does it? They might be. The measure of right and wrong is not whether or not it works. Sometimes we get that way. We say, well, let's do this in the church. That'll work. It works for these other churches. Does that mean it's good? No. What's our standard? Thus says the Lord. If he says no, our answer should be no, regardless of whether there is statistical analysis that says it works. If God says yes, then our answer should be yes. Do you know how many studies I have seen recently that talk about how disciplining your children is actually harmful for them? How many of you disciplined your kids? And I'm not talking about just one type. Because nobody uses one type of discipline, right? You use manifold types of discipline. Sometimes it's verbal correction. Sometimes it's corporal correction. Sometimes it's sit on your bed. Sometimes it's no video games. Sometimes it's you're staying home for a week. Correction bad for your children? Absolutely not. Okay. But the world is constantly, Satan is constantly trying to establish for himself his own standard, his own system of right and wrong, and then he tries to judge God by it. God wants you to be happy, right, Cynthia? Sure. Is that God's primary concern in our lives, that we be happy? No. God wants us to be right. He wants us to be right with Him. And ultimately, that's where we'll find the most happiness. But the goal of our lives is not to be happy, is it? God didn't create me and put me here so that I could be happy. He put me and created me here so that I could worship Him. And I will find the greatest joy there. But boy, if we've learned anything from our study in Matthew, following Christ comes at a cost. It will bring you into trouble. It will bring you into tough times. You will be needed. Not N-E-E-D-E-D, K-N-E-A-D-E-D. You'll be stretched. You'll be pounded as God works that leaven through you. So, Amnon has fallen prey to the deceitfulness of sin. God's not right to withhold this girl from me. Therefore, I will not listen. I will do it anyway. God's not right in telling me that the punishment for this sin, you know what the punishment for this type of sin was? Death. Okay? Leviticus 18, 19, and 20, very detailed instructions on sexual relationships, of what God wants us to be doing with that aspect of our lives, and marriage to, or relations with, this close of a relative was forbidden. And God said, the person that commits these crimes will be cut off from his people. Either they are executed or they are banished from the kingdom. Because basically, being banished from the kingdom was the same as a death sentence. You have nowhere to go. No one to protect you. Your life will be in constant jeopardy. And so Amnon has disregarded God's warnings about this. It's not right for God to forbid her to me. I want her. It's not right for God to say that there will be consequences for this. I think I can get away with it. God's wrong. And I'm going to do what I want to do. Amnon has made himself God in the place of Jehovah because he's decided to do what Jehovah has forbidden. Well, one of the problems with the lies that we believe about sin is that they're lies. So when the temptation comes upon you and you think, oh, if I could just have that new iPhone 7, everything. Is that what they're on now? That tells you how up I am with the times. Anybody know what phone we're on? iPhone? I don't know. But we think, oh, if I could just get this new thing, won't life be grand? I mean, look at all it can do. I can pay for my restaurant bill, which by flashing the phone in front of it, I can take pictures. They've been taking pictures for years. I don't even know what the new things they're doing are. I'd be embarrassed to show you our phone because it's just one that you open up and you can barely text on it. We just figured out how to text last week on our phone. So, Dan? Marry your iPhone. Really? I don't believe that at all, because opening up the marriage relationship from one man and one woman wasn't supposed to bring these sorts of sillinesses. They perfectly well told us it wouldn't go that way, didn't they? But we said, yeah, sure it will, because God says this is ludicrous, right? Uh-huh. I have been seeing a lot of things talking about how people are falling in love with robots, and I didn't know you could actually marry your phone, though. So, just so everybody knows, I'll make a blanket statement now. I will not perform a wedding between you and your phone. Right? And I'll have to check with the board on this one, because that's not my say, but I'm pretty sure you can't use the sanctuary here for a wedding between you and your phone. All right? Maybe that we'll need to put that on the next agenda, Gary. So, well, Amnon believed the lie, number one, that God is wrong and the consequences would not come to him. But he also believed the lie that this was actually going to satisfy his craving. Sin does that. It tries to convince us that if we give into it, it'll deliver us the world. It'll deliver us all of our happiness. It'll deliver us all the satisfaction and pleasure that we've been craving. But it always actually delivers disappointment. And that's what Amnon's going to experience. Look at verse 15. Then Amnon hated her. What? Really? He hates her now? That was fast. That's a pretty quick change. He commits the deed. Now he hates her with a very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he loved her. Now understand, the Old Testament word for love gets used in a multitude of ways. We're not talking about a genuine love here, are we? Obviously, we're just talking about an attraction, a desire that he had. And now it has completely reversed itself because he's experiencing the guilt and the shame and the disappointment that comes with having given in to temptation. And so now he hates her. He's disgusted with her. Can't believe she would do such a thing, right? Well, that's where he's at. Doesn't sin always want to blame somebody else too? Whose fault is it that this didn't go the way Amnon was hoping? We're going to find out who he's going to blame for this, okay? Amnon said to her, "Get up, go out." It's a very strong statement that he makes here. He is kicking her out of the house. And not in a polite, "Well, I think maybe it's time for you to go" sort of way. This is, "Get out of here now." And look what else he does. Well, sorry, verse 16. She's going to respond, "No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you did to me." This is a bold gal. She's willing to keep trying to correct him. Because sending her away is going to be worse to her than keeping her there and admitting what's happened. Because the way that he is sending her out is to treat her as if she had made an indecent proposal to him. See, he's blaming her. And so he's going to call the servants. Verse 17, he wouldn't listen to her. So he called the young man who served him and said, "Put this woman out of my presence," and bolt the door after her. Not even a gentle, "Boy, I'm so sorry, Tamar. This was a mistake. I should not have done that. I'm sorry. I'll do whatever we can to fix the problem." Kick this woman, won't even name her, out of the house and lock the door. By pushing her out of the house in this fashion, Amnon is making a statement. He's treating her as if she had been a prostitute, come to his house and offered her services, and that he was the righteous one denying it and sending her away. Isn't that lovely? Isn't that a great irony? But there it is. This is what sin does to us. Always makes us ignore the consequences when we believe its lies. Always leaves us disappointed. Always leaves us broken. And always leaves us blaming everybody else. So whose fault is it that he didn't enjoy this as much as he wanted to? It's her fault. So send her out of here. Get her out of here. This woman's a disgrace. He kicks her out of the house despite her protestations. Verse 18, now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So this is how we know that David had more than one daughter, even though only one girl's name appears in the genealogy lists, and that's Tamar's. Why does Tamar's name appear in the genealogical lists? Because of this event. She was very well known because of what happened here. Okay. So this long-robed gown that she has on clearly identifies her as one of the king's daughters. And what did the king's son just do to her, aside from the rape? He just treated her like a prostitute. Kicked her out of the house as if she had made this indecent proposal. He's shaming her. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. Verse 19, and Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore. Very symbolic there, because she recognizes she's no longer the virgin daughter of the king. She's now been violated. And so she tears the robe to signify that. The ashes on her head signify great distress. Her hand on her head. In the next sentence, she laid her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went, as a symbol that God's hand is pressing down upon her. She's undergoing some terrible, terrible circumstances. And she runs through the street crying aloud. Now this is also not just the weeping with tears crying. This is a screaming sort of cry. There's nobody that lives around Absalom that would not have heard this, would not have noticed this girl running through the streets, tearing the robe that she wore, throwing ashes on her head, running home, screaming. Well, she gets home, verse 20, and her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you?" whether she told him what happened or whether Absalom knew of Amnon's desires, we're not told, but Absalom determines what has actually happened, and he's going to try and comfort his sister. He says, hold your peace, my sister. Hold her peace because, okay, 21st century, guy violates you this way, what do you do? Call the police. Yes. 10th century BC, what's a girl do? She has no legal standing. On top of that, she could, under the Mosaic law, she could bring charges. But what does she not have? Proof. Okay, capital crime has to have two witnesses in order to execute somebody. She doesn't have it. Now, the servants that are in the house, probably pretty loyal to Absalom, probably wouldn't say anything. He sent them out of the room, so they didn't see anything that went on. But obviously, I'm sorry, what did I say? I said Absalom. Strike that from the record. Amnon's the one that did it, okay? I'm glad you all are more on top of things than I am here. All right. So, she has no proof, and so Absalom tells her, just hold your peace. Don't make a big deal out of this. But what has Absalom got in mind? Yeah. Well, I'm jumping ahead of myself there a little bit, sorry. So Tamar lived, a desolate woman, in her brother Absalom's house, never married, never bore children, but her brother Absalom took care of her all the rest of his days. When King David heard of all these things, what does he do? Nothing. As the king of Israel, what should he have done? He would have looked into the matter. There should have been a trial. But again, we've said there's not much proof here. There's not enough to convict Amnon with. We don't have two witnesses. The girl would be one witness. She could say what happened. But do you think Amnon would bear witness against himself? Not likely. Okay? So, you don't have enough proof for a capital case. As a father, what could he do? Oh, you better believe there could be discipline for this. Absolutely. What was there? Nothing. This is one of the failings that we see in David's life, is that as a father, he wasn't the greatest example. He didn't discipline his children the way that he should have. Until we get to one of them. We find out in the book of Proverbs that he did take a great deal of time training and instructing which son? Solomon. One of his younger sons. But in his early years, maybe because of establishing a new kingdom, all the wars that he was fighting, all of the demands of being king, David was somewhat of an absentee dad. He wasn't around much and he didn't train his children. And so we're seeing some of the results of this. He's angry, but he doesn't do anything about it. And that's the implication that is stated here. He's angry, but he doesn't do anything. He doesn't discipline Amnon for this. Doesn't even verbally rebuke him. And so Absalom, having told his sister to keep her peace and seeing David's response, spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad. You ever get the silent treatment from somebody? Maybe, I won't ask if you've ever given it to anybody. Okay. Well, Absalom is giving Amnon the silent treatment. He's not talking to him. I can imagine the stares at the dinner table on family game night when David would call all of his sons and daughters from their respective houses and have Thanksgiving dinner together. You can just see Absalom staring across the table at his brother and say, Absalom, you're really cutting that turkey pretty vigorously. What's going through your head there, buddy? But he said nothing to him, good or bad. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister. David has sowed the seeds of sin into his family, and he's beginning to reap the harvest. As we've said, God has built the world in such a way that when we sow sinful decisions, we reap bad consequences. Read the book of Proverbs. an entire book for us, written on the premise, if you make decision A, you get consequence B. So if it's a good decision, you get good consequences. If it's a bad decision, you get bad consequences. Generally speaking, now you got to understand the Proverbs are what we call generalisms. Generally speaking, it's true. Most of the time, this is the way it'll go. Sometimes will it not go that way? Sure. Proverbs has a lot to say about debt. If you borrow a lot of money, what does Proverbs tell us debt equals? Servitude. The borrower is servant to the lender. So if I borrow a lot of money, I become a slave of the person to whom I owe a lot of money. I wind up spending all my time working to pay off my debts, right? Debt equals servitude. So when a nation has 1.1 times its gross domestic product in debt, what does that mean? We're a nation of slaves. We will wind up working to pay off our debt. That's a whole other topic, so you can ask me about that privately. Personally speaking, though, if you borrow a lot of money, you will wind up in servitude, having to work multiple jobs in order to pay off the debt at some point. Now, has it worked sometimes that people borrow large amounts of money and never have to pay it off? Sure, sometimes that happens. But generally speaking, debt equals servitude of some kind. Okay. Well, are there bad consequences for adulterous relationships like this? Yes, there are. David committed an act in his own house that his children saw. They probably knew about it. The whole kingdom was probably buzzing about it. This would have been trending on Facebook. King commits adultery with general's wife. King murders general. Would have been flying around on emails, everybody talking about it. Twitter feed would have been going crazy with this. People knew what was going on. And guess what it sowed in his household? What happened to David? Because of his murder of Uriah and his adultery. Did David get executed for that? God pardoned him, didn't he? And what did Amnon learn from that? I can take what I want and get away with it. Amnon learned the lesson of mercy the wrong way. Sometimes God is merciful to us and he completely negates the consequences of our actions. Sometimes he allows us to go through them. David wasn't killed. He wasn't executed by the Lord for his sin with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. And his children took that lesson the wrong way. It didn't teach them to depend deeply upon mercy and God's grace. It taught them to flaunt it. Where Paul says, "Should we continue in sin that grace may abound?" David said, "Absolutely not. I've learned my lesson." And he began the necessary corrections in his life. David's children said, "Yeah. If I'm going to continue in sin and there's going to be grace, then sure, why not?" And that's what Amnon did. He took what he wanted, despite the fact that it was forbidden, acting like there were going to be no consequences. From his father, there aren't. From the man from whom consequences should have come, both as a king and as a dad, there were none. But there will be. We go to verse 23, because now we're actually getting into the section that I titled, "The Sword Takes Residence in David's House." You remember the curse that God placed upon David because he murdered Uriah? Back in chapter 12, verse 10, God told David, "The sword shall never depart from your house because you have done this thing." This is where it begins, because Absalom now has a vendetta. Absalom has been letting his rage build. How long? Verse 23. Two full years. David's done nothing, but Absalom has been pondering this. He's been plotting it. He's had time to make his plans as to how he's going to avenge himself upon his brother Amnon. It has a twofold stroke of genius for Absalom. Number one, it's going to avenge a wrong that was committed against his sister. But number two, where does Absalom fall in the lineup to be king? He's after Amnon. It's Amnon. There was another boy named Kileab who probably died young. And then there's Absalom. So if Amnon is taken out of the picture, what does that mean? Hey, Absalom gets to be king next, right? So kind of a double whammy for him. So, after 2 full years, Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hazor. Remember last week we talked about how Absalom and Amnon are grown men. These are not young teenagers. They're grown men. They have fully established households of their own. Absalom has got this flock of sheep, and it's the time of year to shear them. I think I saw, Dan, some old sheep shearers in the auctions the other day. You know, the old metal ones with the big spring on the end. And can you imagine shearing hundreds of sheep with that thing? Boy, your arm would just be tuckered out. Did you ever have to do sheep shearing? You guys had sheep, didn't you, Jerry?
Yeah, but they had an electric one.
Okay. They had electricity when you were kids? I'm sorry, that's mean. That's mean. I shouldn't do that to you. All right. So sheep shearing was a big thing. I don't know if they were still, if they still do this, but it was a time to throw a feast. Patricia was telling me about corn shelling time and how you had to bake for all the guys that were out there and pies and stuff. Well, that's a very long-standing tradition because sheep shearing was a time all the workers would come together, all the shepherds, and you would have a huge feast to celebrate the incoming of this harvest of wool. And that's what Absalom is doing. And it was a huge expense. The amount of food and drink that would be consumed during this time was immense. And so it was a big, big expense, but you have to think about the amount of wealth coming off of those sheep. We don't put a whole lot of value on fabrics anymore because we don't like wool. It's too itchy. So we like our cotton, but that gets wrinkly, so we wear polyester, which is just plastic. Well, that's pretty easy to make compared to spinning wool into threads fine enough for clothing, right? But this was a big deal. And so his sheep shearers are at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. That's north of Jerusalem, about 15, 20 miles. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. Verse 24, and Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." This is the official invitation. And since he didn't have Evites, he goes to dad personally. Comes to dad and says, I want everybody to come to my house. Now, this is not just David. He wants David, he wants the children, and he wants all the servants of David to come to his house. Absalom is planning something big. He wants this to be public. He's been plotting this revenge for quite a while, and he wants everybody to see it, including dad. But David refuses. The king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go, lest we be burdensome to you." Why would that be burdensome? Because it's expensive. That's a lot of money to go out for all those servants of the royal palace. All of the military commanders, all of the cabinet and the advisors are supposed to come along with David. And so David says, no, Absalom, that'll break your bank. We can't have a dinner like that. You go ahead, enjoy it. He says, we don't want to be burdensome to you. He pressed him, that is, Absalom pressed David. Yeah, you can see the big puppy dog eyes. And the please. Oh. Probably not quite like that, but in a grown-up way. We beg as grown-ups, don't we? Sometimes, okay? We do. We just do it in a little more sophisticated ways than four-year-olds do it, right? So Absalom's begging a little bit, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing. In other words, Absalom, I'm not going to go. You go ahead. Have a good time. Enjoy yourself. Then Absalom said, if you won't come, Dad, then please let my brother Amnon go with us. Now, I don't know if this sends up a bunch of red flags into David's head. If he says, but he asks the question. Why should he go with you? Why do you want Amnon to come? Now, he just asked for the whole house because he wanted everybody to come. And so now he's trying to reformulate his plan. It's fallen apart. David's not going along with this because David doesn't want the whole house to go. So he's trying desperately to still get Amnon in a position where he can kill him. So he's got to ask specifically. So his plan's fallen apart a little bit here. But David says, well, why should he go with you? And the answer again. If at first you can't get permission, beg harder. Right? So if you ask, can I have ice cream tonight for supper? and mom says no, like moms usually do, being concerned about health and welfare and all that, then you say, please, oh, come on, mom, I just want some ice cream. It's been hot all day. Can't we have some ice cream? So Absalom begs even more until the point he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. All right, Absalom, I'm not coming. The royal cabinet's not coming. Military commanders aren't coming. You and your brothers go. Have a good time. Amnon can come with you. Verse 28, then Absalom commanded his servants, mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant. I think it's hilariously ironic that Absalom is telling his servants, you be courageous, you be valiant, be brave, you're going to kill a man. That takes a lot of guts, doesn't it? And they're going to say, Master Absalom, why don't you be brave and valiant? He doesn't want to do it himself. You notice a lesson that he might have learned from Dad here? God was very clear. David, you killed Uriah. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Who did it? The Ammonite soldiers. Who intended it? David. Who intends this murder of Amnon? Absalom does. Who's going to carry it out? His servants. Get into whole ethical debates. Should they obey this order or shouldn't they obey this order? The point is, Absalom is the one commanding it. This is all his intention. I want Amnon dead. So when he's getting drunk, when he's getting happy and stupid, thinks he's the funniest guy in the world telling dumb jokes, that's the time I'm going to tell you to strike him down. Don't hesitate. Don't hold back. Just strike him, because I commanded you. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. We get the description of the murder in very short, terse terms. No bloody descriptions. He's dead. The servants have done it. Right at dinner. Now, some of us might have tense dinners once in a while. Family relations are like that occasionally. There's sometimes some discord and strife. Anybody ever had... Maybe I shouldn't ask that, because it probably could happen, right? I was going to say, anybody ever have a murder at your Christmas dinner? But this is what it is. They're all sitting there. They're enjoying themselves. They're talking, sharing memories about, hey, do you remember when Kileab was a little kid and he climbed that rock wall, fell off and broke his... Ah, wasn't that funny? Yeah. Remember the time we stayed up all night and... Sharing all these memories, and suddenly Absalom looks across the table and says, now, do it. The servants run up with knives, and in a few moments, Amnon is dead. Well, naturally, everybody responds the way we probably all would. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. Get out of here. Make for the hills. Save yourselves. I can think of faster ways to run than on a mule, but... I assume it's faster than running, but I don't know. Can you get a mule to run? Anybody ever had mules? Okay. I've ridden horses. I've never ridden a mule, but they run. Okay. So they jump on their mules, and they're off, and they're running away. Because there's no understanding there that maybe Absalom has it in for everybody. Maybe this is a military coup. And Absalom's trying to secure the throne for himself by wiping out all of David's sons. They don't know. And so he kills the first one. The prime target would be the oldest, because then Absalom is next in line, but the rest of them don't know. And so they all get up and run. They take off. And while they were on the way, what's the old saying? Bad news travels on swift wings. Somehow, the news of what's happened outruns the mules and gets to David before any of his sons do. And here's the report in verse 30. While they were on the way, news came to David, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons and not one of them is left. Ever notice how bad news tends to get exaggerated? Okay. Well, happened the same back in the 10th century BC as it does today. Don't believe the first news reports that come out. You all have to wait a little while until they actually get some feet on the ground and figure out what's going on. Okay. Well, that's the first news report. All of your sons are dead. David hears this news. Verse 31, then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth. He falls on the ground wailing and weeping because of his grief. And all his servants who were standing by tore their garments. They're going to share in the grief with their master. But Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, does anybody recognize this name? Yes, he's the one that counseled Amnon 2 years ago to rape his sister. This is a great guy to have around, isn't it? That's sarcasm, by the way, just in case we missed that. But he's family. What can you do? This is David's nephew, his brother Shimeah. David's brother Shimeah is this guy's dad. But he's hanging around, and he sees everybody fall on the ground, weeping and wailing, mourning the loss of all the king's sons, and he says, oh, don't let my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon alone is dead. Now, wouldn't you want to stand up and look at this guy and say, how do you know? Now, wait a second. Jonadab. You helped plot Amnon's rape of Tamar. Any chance you're involved in the plot against Amnon? You're a, what was the description that was used of him? Back early, he's a crafty man. He's good at coming up with scenarios to sneak around, all right? So, one way or another, now, we don't know that he was in on the murder plot. Maybe he just deduced, I got Amnon in trouble. My guess is that Absalom only killed Amnon because of the situation with Tamar. Maybe that's all that's going on in Jonadab's mind. But he tells David, don't suppose that all the young men are dead. It's just Amnon. Would that comfort you, dads? Someone comes in, every one of your children's dead. And someone else standing nearby says, no, it's not all of them, just one. It's okay, right? Everything's good? No, everything's not good. Even if one of your sons is dead. He instructs us a little bit here too. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king so take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead. Verse 34, tragic consequences are continuing, but Absalom fled. Why would Absalom flee? He just had a lot more than two witnesses. Everybody saw this happen, right? So he is in danger of a trial that would convict him to a death sentence. So he flees. The young men who kept watch, this is back in Jerusalem, lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, many people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. So this is a guy up on the wall that protects the city of Jerusalem. David is probably right down here at the gate, lying on the ground, his robe torn, he's throwing dust on his head. All of the counselors of Israel are down there doing the same. And the watchman up on the tower looks off in the distance and sees a group of people riding their mules furiously heading for Jerusalem. And so Jonadab said to the king, behold, the king's son have come. As your servant said, so it has come about. So this is basically, I told you, David, don't worry, it's only Amnon. Here's all the rest of them. He sees them riding in on their mules as they come around the mountain of Jerusalem and come towards the main gate where David's at. And as soon as he had finished speaking, behold, the king's son came and lifted up their voice and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ahimaaz, king of Geshur. We have notice this guy before. Does anybody remember who Talmai, the king of Geshur, is?
He's the one who hired David and gave him the land.
Nope. Talmai, the king of Geshur. This is Absalom's granddaddy on his mother's side. Absalom's mom was a princess of Geshur, the daughter of Talmai. So, naturally, you're in big trouble. Where would you run? I'm going to grandpa's house. Because he's a king, he can protect me, he won't extradite me back to Israel where I'll be executed. He can keep me safe. And so he goes and seeks sanctuary with Grandpa. David mourned for his son day after day. Which son is he mourning for? Amnon. He's mourning for Amnon, okay? Because he's dead. Absalom fled, went to Geshur, and was there for 3 years. So this whole event in David's life takes about 5 years, okay? We're looking, David has probably been king now for some 25 years. Absalom and Amnon are in their early to mid-20s. And this whole thing takes 5 more years. Solomon is probably born during this time. Up until David has been ruling for about 30 years is when this happens. So we'll take a look at the timeline next week a little bit to give you an idea there. But that's kind of where we're at. David's been sitting on the throne for about 25 years. And by the time it's all over, this will have taken about 30 years. And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead. So after 3 years, David's heart does start to turn a little bit. He was angry with Amnon for what he did at Tamar, but he didn't do anything. He was angry at Absalom because of his murder of Amnon, but as time goes on, he begins to miss the son that's still alive, and his heart starts reaching out towards Absalom, even though David himself is not going to take any steps at this point to rectify the situation. But the sword has come to dwell in David's house, just as God said that it would. And the kingly lesson in all of this for us is, be careful what you sow. You will reap. God's merciful. He's gracious. He forgives us. He restores us to a right relationship with Himself. But oftentimes, the sins that we sow will reap consequences far into our future and into our children's future even. Make sure you're ruled by the word of the Lord. Don't let your guard down for a moment. Letting your guard down for even a moment can cost dearly throughout the rest of your life. And that's not saying that God will never use you again. That's not saying God will never love you again, because He's good. He's very good. But our decisions do have consequences. And David is starting to see that as God's curse, as prophecy comes to fulfillment. The sword shall never depart from your house because of what you've done. Any questions about all that? We covered a lot of ground tonight. I'll give you a chance to clarify.